Good morning. Welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams. New Mexico can be a tough place for kids to grow up. Our state has the country's highest poverty levels for children. Teen pregnancies are high. Schools and mental health programs are underfunded. But we're now in the second week of the 2016 budget session in the state legislature. So far, more than 40 of the bills introduced are focused on improving life for children in some way. Things like funding for SNAP benefits, violence against children, early childhood education. But what is the reality that New Mexico's kids are living in terms of health, education, and safety? Do the bills under consideration in Santa Fe get to the root of the problem in terms of the hardships many of New Mexico's kids face? We want to hear from you. Give us a call at 277-5866 with your take on what's being done and what needs to be done. Joining us to talk about these issues facing kids in New Mexico this morning and some possible fixes are Gilbert Ramirez, who runs the social work program at Health Leadership High School in Albuquerque, and Deborah Harris, consultant with the New Mexico Association for Infant Mental Health. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi.
Well, Gilbert, let's start with you. There's a lot of bills this session that are focused on education, ranging from a lot of different, subjects in education, because I know that's a kind of a complex issue where there's a lot of needs. And I thought maybe we could start by you talking about some of the needs that you see with your work in the high schools in Albuquerque.
Sure, absolutely. I'm part of a public charter school here in Albuquerque, New Mexico, a Health Leadership High School, and our charter was opened and founded on the idea that we would have a very strong social-emotional support pillar to look at the needs of adolescents and what's going on with them. And so I'm very fortunate to be part of a school coming from APS. I was in APS for over 13 years as a social worker, and our work was very specific and designated to just one population of students, primarily those who had a special ed education diagnosis or eligibility and who had a service. Coming to this school, I was asked to come in and create a school with an entire department to focus on those social-emotional needs. So I'm very fortunate to have two other social workers on staff with myself, a population of about 150 students. And I also have three social work graduate level social work interns. So we're very heavy on the mental health and behavioral health supports at our school. The needs are definitely there. I think knowing the conditions that we have in our state with regards to poverty, hunger, homelessness, and how that affects families, job issues, and also understanding that we have students in this state who are either non-resident, non-legal status, who are fearful of reaching out for those services or don't have access to it because they don't have insurance, yet they're still in our public school systems. How do we create in-house systems that don't definitely require funding or payment to provide those services? And that's what we're trying to do. And we do see the needs daily. Our young people are coming in with a lot of challenges. And honestly, my firm belief, and I think the mission of our school, is understanding that if students aren't in a stability place social emotionally, they're not going to learn. They're not going to move forward. Those issues weigh heavily upon them, and therefore their focus and ability to grasp content, move forward academically, do well on the tests that they're being given, it's not going to be present just based on the fact that they have other issues compounding in their life that's not going to allow them to move forward.
Well, give us some specific examples of some of the issues that you see and maybe some ways that that we could look to fix them in the legislature.
A lot of our young people are coming in with either undiagnosed mental health issues or diagnosed mental health issues, but there hasn't been stability in either treatment or access to medications to allow them to have stability in their lives. So we have the gamut from young people dealing with depression, ADD, as well as unhealthy relationships that they're involved in, substance abuse, unfortunately, family dynamics that aren't all functioning well in a way that it impacts them because they're either moving from place to place or they're bouncing from parent to parent because that's where they're coming from. These issues are prevalent, and therefore we are working to create groups at our school and things like that. I think the state took a big hit with the behavioral health care kind of management, how that went, and with that came a loss in access to a lot of services. What ended up happening is that, schools are going to be the next go-to position to help these adolescent and young people because no other institution has young children more than their families in the school. You're not seeing the involvement anymore as much with either churches or other institutions that provide that help. So schools are then left with the burden to kind of figure out what do we do to adapt and meet the needs of the young people.
Well, Deborah Harris, you work on infant health, infant well-being, and right. mental health. I mean, and so I guess a lot of the problems that Gilbert sees once the kids are getting to high school start in your field when you're looking at, you know, when you're looking at babies and youngsters. What are some of the issues that you think are important this session to be looking at in terms of infant mental health? I know we have some specific bills.
Yes, and thank you. Absolutely. We think that if we can intervene early and in terms of infant mental health, we have a continuum of services from what we call prevention to intervention to treatment. And I think it's a well-known fact now that the most significant period of brain development happens prenatally in the first 3 years of life. And critical to that are healthy relationships. So in a state that has chronically been last in terms of the Annie E. Casey report for child well-being, what is it that we're not attending to? I find it remarkable that year after year, I think this is our 10th year possibly, that we're in the between 48th to 50 that New Mexico ranks last, dead last, in child well-being and how that's not being addressed in terms of the specifics, and Gilbert referred to some of those. So from my field, in terms of infant well-being, infant mental health, and many people that are not familiar with that term question it and think, well, how can you do therapy with babies? And what is mental health for infants? Is that a baby on a psychiatrist's couch? And it's not. It's about well-being. It's exactly what you're talking about. But it's not being talked about in terms of legislative, in terms of policy, and in terms of funding. There is a stalwart group in New Mexico, and you mentioned the New Mexico Association for Infant Mental Health. And we also have been very fortunate to move forward programs like home visiting, prenatal services. And there is another, I think, less known, more intervention and treatment component that is been funded to a small degree, and we're hoping that a couple of the bills that are being presented, ones being presented today, will help further infant mental health treatment, and that is services to our highest risk babies, babies that are have been or at risk for abuse and neglect, both emotional and physical, and how we have highly trained infant mental health clinicians, and there's a set of competencies. We have something in New Mexico called the New Mexico Infant Teams. Those teams, we have seven now in different judicial districts, get referrals from protective services for babies that are taken into custody, birth to three, that have significant range of abuse, neglect, and severe medical conditions from abuse. And it takes a trained workforce. It takes a workforce that is available in rural communities. We have real barriers to access in our state because we are rural, we are low income, and we don't have enough providers. And so I think our efforts in terms of infants and young children have been, how can we build capacity in our state for this specialized services, people that know about development, people that know about neurobiology, people that know about the impact of trauma, and can engage with families from diverse backgrounds and situations. And we really need to keep these services funded.
Well, you mentioned some of the rankings that New Mexico, I think listeners to our show will be familiar with hearing that we rank low in terms of child well-being, child poverty, and a lot of those other metrics. But we have Veronica Garcia here from New Mexico Voices for Children, who just came out with her organization's own ranking. Well, I guess it's not exactly a ranking document, but the Kids Count survey looks at a lot of the indicators of child well-being. And I think that's something important to look at when we're talking about this funding session in the legislature. Veronica, can you talk a little bit about what you've identified in terms of the biggest needs for the young people here in this state?
Certainly. Good morning to everyone, and it's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. New Mexico Voices for Children produces a data book in January of each year. And we look at the 16 indicators that Casey measures, and we look at New Mexico and how is New Mexico trending overall in child well-being. Child well-being is made up of four domains: economic well-being, education, health, and family and community. And what we find, you know, as we heard a while ago about the importance of early childhood from prenatally, all the way through pre-K, is just critical for the reasons that we've just heard. But we have to look at children holistically, and I think that's why Annie E. Casey looks at them in this manner. So poverty is something that we should be very concerned about, because while the rest of the nation is coming out of the recession, New Mexico is still there, and we have the highest child poverty rate for preschool. We have we're 42% lower than we were in 2009. While there have been increases in funding, you know, we're still way behind. Children or young people not graduating from high school on time is still a major issue. Families who are burdened by high housing costs is very much a concern. In terms of health, we saw a few improvements. Low birth weight babies, that is a trend that has improved by a less than a percent, but it's still an improvement. As has teen birth, teen births have also gone down. But here's an area that we got worse: parents without a high school diploma. We know that educational attainment levels are very much correlated to the educational attainment levels of the parents, primarily the mother. And so, again, if we don't break that cycle repeats itself. Their children are more likely not to graduate from high school, and so on. So I'd be happy. I mean, I don't want to take up all the time because there's 16 indicators. So I'll let you kind of guide me where you'd like to go from here.
Right. Well, I think we have time to get to a lot more of those. But we want to hear from you. Do you have a child who would benefit from anything that's being looked at in the legislature right now? Things like early childhood education, fitness programs in school, domestic violence even. How do you want your tax money to be spent on kids? And you can call our local number at 277-5866 in Albuquerque. Toll-free number is 877-899-5866. You can also send us an email at callinshow@kunm.org or post comments to our webpage at kunm.org. Now, Veronica, you mentioned in your in a press release that you sent out about the Kids Count survey that addressing, I'm quoting you now, addressing these disparities has to be a high priority when three-quarters of the state's children are racial and ethnic minorities. But that's not an issue that appears to gain much traction in Santa Fe. What do you mean? Are legislators not paying attention to these things?
They're not taking bold action to turn this around. And the, you know, we just heard now that revenue is down, right? Mm-hmm. We know that there have been corporate tax cuts with the idea that it would create jobs and generate more revenue. That has not happened. In the meantime, we're losing children every year, you know. Approximately 25,000 to 26,000 children are born. We have about the same amount in each grade, pretty much 25,000 to 27,000 kids. You look at the children that are receiving pre-K or receiving home visitation, it's a fraction. And we know that to turn the economy around, we've looked at the work of James Heckman. He's a Nobel Prize laureate. Art Rolnick, who tell us that the best investment a state can make in improving its economy is to invest in early childhood education. We have an opportunity to be able to infuse about $150 million a year. It would not totally cover the cost, but could make allow us to have build capacity, to have home visitation programs in the most needed areas, to work on pre-K, to finish the pre-K rollout. And that is to pass a constitutional amendment to allow New Mexicans to vote on whether we should take 1.5% from the land-grant permanent fund for early childhood education. And this has gone to the legislature for the last 5 years. We've been defeated by a particular committee that does not want this to be heard. It's House Joint Resolution 10 and Senate Joint Resolution 2. This resolution has safeguards in it to prevent erosion of the fund. And a journal poll 2 years ago showed that New Mexicans overwhelmingly agreed that we should use this investment for early childhood education. And my colleagues here have made a strong point why these early years are so important in terms of the brain development. We have a tremendous opportunity in that we have this land-grant permanent fund that's the third largest in the country, 13th largest in the world. that we will, you know, there are safeguards in it to ensure the health of the fund. Even through the worst economic times, that fund grew. So we have the opportunity to make a huge difference, and we're not taking it.
Well, what do your kids need to grow up safe and healthy? I mean, you out there in the audience is who I'm talking to, but what do you hear from your kids? Are you a young person yourself, or do you work with youth? And if so, what do you think needs to be done to make this a better place to grow up? We're going to take a short break here, and then we'll be right back to take some calls.
Edible Arrangements at 4770 Montgomery Boulevard Northeast in Albuquerque offers fresh fruit bouquets and chocolate-dipped fruit for any occasion. EdibleArrangements.com or 505-888-0100. Edible Arrangements is a valued supporter of KUNM.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, a special program highlighting the top peacemaking communication themes heard in Peace Talks Radio interviews over the years.
Deep, transformative listening. We're not trained in that very well. In the rest of the world, they joke about Americans. The joke is, to an American, what's the opposite of speaking? And the answer is waiting to speak.
Top peacemaking communication themes next time on Peace Talks Radio.
Friday morning at 8 on 89.9 KUNM.
This is KUNM 89.9, broadcasting from the University of New Mexico. We're back talking about the needs of kids here and how those needs are being represented in the Roundhouse this session with social worker Gilbert Ramirez, Veronica Garcia of the New Mexico Voices for Children, and infant mental health consultant Deborah Harris. Our number is 277-5866 locally in Albuquerque. Toll-free number is 877-899-5866. You can join the conversation on Twitter, where we're live tweeting the program. Our handle is at KUNM News, and our hashtag is HealthNM. We want to hear from you. Are these problems that can even be fixed by lawmakers in Santa Fe? What's being left out of the discussion? You can also call our local number. It's 277, again, 5866, toll-free, 877-899-5866. Let's go to a call now. Rick is on the line from Albuquerque. Hi, Rick.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning,
good morning
Rick.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Thank you for having me on the program.
Sure. Go right ahead.
Well, I just have a simple comment. It's about funding in New Mexico. It's a constant problem we seem to have. It seems to be a roller coaster based on energy prices. And there was a mention of taking money out of the land grant, and that sounds a little drastic, but I have another possible solution for the problem in the long run for funding Medicaid and education programs that help kids, which would be an indexed fuel tax, which would tax gasoline when it's cheap, like right now, be fairly painless, and then the tax would automatically come off as the price of energy went up and New Mexico reaped the benefits of severance taxes. And this would automatically smooth out differences in funding. We want to fund more prisons now and things like that. It's going to cost money. So the governor's talked about rearranging priorities, and we know where that's going to come from. It's going to come from the programs that help kids. So this would be a simple solution. The problem is it is a tax, and so none of the politicians are brave enough to ever mention a tax, even though this would be a totally painless tax.
Thanks, Rick.
For most consumers.
Well, something then that's not on the call right now, something that's not being looked at in the legislature, but that you say could be a good solution for funding these kinds of programs in the future.
And mentioning it to our legislators, because we know why they wouldn't do something like this, and that is because anything that has the word tax in it is going to be fought, particularly by one party.
Right.
But they're actually happy about cutting funding for a lot of these programs.
Well, thanks a lot, Rick.
You know,
to jump back a little bit, no matter where the funding is coming from, I mean, there's a root issue here when we're looking at the problems that kids face in New Mexico, and that's the fact that, you know, your ethnic background, your economic background really is a primary issue in terms of what your future looks like and what struggles you're going to have in the future. I mean, that's something that you found, Veronica, with New Mexico Voices for Children in your research. Can you talk a little bit about that? And I'm also interested from hearing from you, Gilbert and Deborah, about what you've seen in terms of economic and racial disparities in well-being.
Well, we definitely see that people of color in our state tend to be at the lower socioeconomic levels. And there's a myriad of reasons for some of that, that cycles of poverty continue, not having equal opportunity, institutional racism. I mean, we could go on and on about some of the issues that impact it. But what we have to look at and stay focused on are solutions. And how can we, you know, this gentleman was talking about a gas tax, which is a regressive tax, which then again disproportionately impacts the poor. We made, back in 2003 and then again 2 years ago, passed corporate tax cuts that, you know, lost us hundreds of millions of dollars that we would have right now had we not made them with the idea that it was an economic strategy that would create jobs. We believe that we need to make this sort of investment with a proven strategy that would, in fact, turn the economy around if we have a healthy and educated workforce. Those early years are so critical. And my colleague here, I think you spoke about adverse childhood experiences.
Not yet, but please do.
Well, you're the expert in it, but we know that adverse childhood experiences impact cognitive development and exacerbates a problem about children already coming to school behind.
Well, let's hold that right there, because you're mentioning adverse childhood experiences, and I do want to hear more about that. But one, there's a lot of measures in the legislature right now that are focused specifically on safety, well-being, things like domestic violence. And of course, one that's gotten a lot of attention is the child porn issue. Attorney General Hector Balderas has said this is one of his priorities this session. Didn't make it through last, but maybe looking more hopeful this time. And we do have on the phone Anthony Mays, who is a special agent of prosecutor for Attorney General Hector Balderas. Hi, Anthony.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about what this loophole is that the Attorney General is hoping to fix, and what the basic kind of background on this issue is in New Mexico.
Okay. So currently the Supreme Court, and we understand why the Supreme Court found that if a person is in possession of, let's say, 400 images of a child being objectified, exploited, raped, that individual can only be charged with being in possession of one image based on the way the law is written.
Right, right. And so the measure in front of the legislature right now would mean that you get charged for every image that you possess.
And that is correct. And now, and for clarification, in most cases, the images are images of different children. So each one of those images is evidence of a child being sexually exploited in some way. So those are individual images.
Well, now, are these kids in these images from New Mexico? Or are you trying to catch predators that are getting images from elsewhere? I mean, who is being victimized exactly here?
They're from all over the country. We have found several of the child pornography being manufactured here in New Mexico, and then, of course, all over the country and throughout the world. So it isn't unusual that we find an individual that's actually manufacturing child pornography here and then transmitting it or sharing with other folks.
Right. So I guess that would be a pretty adverse experience for a child to have. I mean, how big – can you give us an idea of the scope of this issue? It certainly has gotten a lot of attention.
Sure. So at any one time, we know there's up to about 3,500 individuals downloading child pornography in our state. They use a file-sharing network. In addition to that, what's reported to us from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So just to give you an idea, last year alone, 2015, we received 440 tips from the National Center of individuals that were trying to exploit children in some way, either by enticing them or manufacturing child pornography. Mm. And last year alone, the task force conducted over 441 investigations and made over 81 arrests.
And are you expecting this loophole closing to you know, actually have that number drop? Would we see less victimization of children in New Mexico if, you know, this little legal issue was fixed?
We would, because now, and again, we deal with the sometimes the dark net and the individuals that are out there. some of these individuals know that New Mexico's laws are weak, and that we believe that in some cases they're actually coming here to actually hurt children. So it would change things. Mm-hmm. And we've seen an increase in prosecution or investigation and prosecution over the last 5 years. With these types of cases, this is the first year, or actually 2015, that we actually declined.
Did you decline in the number of prosecutions?
Number of prosecutions and arrests.
Okay. Well, Mr. Mays, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me.
Jumping in and giving us some context on that issue. Guys, is this child porn thing, I mean, is this, it's, nobody wants to see a kid victimized anywhere, mm-hmm. but there are a lot of measures like this in terms of, you know, family violence, the child porn, child abuse, dual sentencing of youthful offenders, a whole list of these safety measures. Do you think that's where we should be putting our attention?
If I could speak to that a little bit, I think when we start looking at exploitation and adverse conditions for young people, we need to look at the conditions that exist around the family and our community that is creating an environment for that to be fostered. So we have parents who are either raising children singly in a single family home, having to work multiple jobs and don't have the time to be present for their children. We have conditions in which children can't access or families can't access childcare because of costs. So they're utilizing people in their neighborhood that maybe they don't know very well, but it's free and they can then lend their children there, which puts them in a position to maybe be in a vulnerable environment. We have to do better on saying the conditions in our economy right now aren't well. Our families have to work longer hours, are getting paid less, therefore they cannot be present for their children, and the only other institutions that are there are going to be schools. Schools are making the appropriate calls, but again, this is all reactionary. And I agree the prosecution laws need to be there, but what's preventing or intervening to allowing families to be present for their families and be there? We have a situation in which we need more access to early child care or early childhood education programs, but can we afford them? Can families access those? We also have a culture that's really prevalent here in New Mexico, that we have citizen-born children to non-citizen families who are fearful of accessing services and getting their children to these systems because of the culture where we're at now with the ID situation, and it's just not a very immigrant-friendly time. Yet these are people who make up our community and families. So I think when we look at exploitation, we have to look at the larger thing of what's promoting that ability for children to be exploited. Absent parents. Absent parents are not there because they're either working, they're out, or the stresses among them create environments in which families have conflict, and then we're dealing with abuse and neglect situations. What are we doing to support families so they can have healthy relationships, that they're not working such long hours, they're not present at home and being there for their children? Those are important factors. I'm not sure if y'all can lend yourselves to that, but we need more supports looking at our minimum wage. I mean, that has constantly been an issue, and again, it's against increasing that raise, yet everything economically has gone up. Families cannot survive on that family income anymore. And now we have a generation, and at our school, we have a re-engagement program. Majority of those students are either expecting or already young parents. They have not been in school because they don't have access to place their children anywhere else. Now that we have an evening program they can come to, we're adapting our school to meet those needs of that community. But I know there are way more parents and students who want to be in school, but because of their children and they don't have the ability to access anything else, are not.
Go ahead, Deborah. You wanted to say something?
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I think if we take it down to the prenatal and infant years, when relationship is so critical, children do not grow, they do not learn, they cannot take in information, their brain does not develop without the context of a relationship. And it can go either way. We talk about tolerable stress, and we talk about toxic stress. And the ACEs that Veronica mentioned are the adverse childhood experiences, and those are cumulative. And we found that the correlation is not only in terms of mental and behavioral health issues, but health issues. This was a large study done by Dr. Folletti and his colleagues on over 10,000 from Kaiser Permanente that had a correlation between early childhood adverse experiences and long-term health, like including cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and mental health issues. So if young children are exposed to this and don't have a supportive early environment, then they're at much greater risk to both repeat those, have health issues that are costly, and mental health issues. We have cut back And I think there's a proposal now to cut back on children's behavioral health services. I do want to say that today there's a House Bill 197 that's being heard, introduced by Donald Tripp, for infant behavioral health services in Socorro. This is a very underserved area. Another Senate Bill 24, which is being sponsored by Jerry Ortiz-Pino, to fund EPSTAT services, which are, again, early childhood screenings. We are systems. There are a number of things that I think contribute to the situation for young people. Our services are very siloed. They're underfunded, but our systems are very siloed in terms of early childhood, not talking to behavioral health services, not talking to disabilities. We have something in this state, it's actually federal, called Part C, which is for children birth to three that have or are at risk of having delays or disabilities. We in New Mexico are one of only seven states that has an at-risk category. That means that children that are in protective services or are at risk of developing these also qualify for services. Not a lot of people know about this. Pediatricians don't know about it. I work a lot with the court system, with foster care. We need to educate those parents that Gilbert was talking about that are so stressed, that have their own ACEs, that have trauma that's unresolved, that gets passed on generationally. Because of our diverse cultures in New Mexico, we have a very high rate of generational trauma.
Well, we have some callers to get through that want to speak to points related to that. One is Paul, who's on the phone with us from Albuquerque. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. Hello. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just, I've been thinking a lot about this just lately because, yesterday I dropped my daughter off for testing for gifted and talented, and I was thinking, well, what does that even mean, and how did she get here? We recently moved to New Mexico. We were living in Minnesota, and we were homeless, and through a whole lot of things. I had a job that was on the road, a kid that was back in town, and I wasn't there for him enough, so I had to quit, and we quickly became homeless. But through availability of affordable housing and programs there in Minneapolis, we were able to get back on our feet pretty quickly, and through the early childhood family education programs that were widely available there, my daughter did really well, and she got scholarships available through funding to good schools and all of this stuff. And then I was able to go to work. My wife was able to go to school. She finished school in nursing. We moved to the res out on the Navajo res for a while for her to work out there. And shortly before that, my youngest son was born, who has not enjoyed all of the resources that my daughter, who was tested for gifted and talented yesterday, has had. He's now in kindergarten, and he's lagging behind a little bit. And, we're working on getting him up now that we're in the city to where he needs to be. But there's not the resources here that were available to families where we came from. And we love New Mexico. People here, we love the people here. And we're a mixed family, and we have enjoyed that here. That seems to be more acceptable, and we really like it. And that this area of childhood development and lack of funding is really a downside, you know, to so many other problems that you discussed already. You can be attributed to this, you know. And
well, Paul, what exactly would help your son right now? I mean, are there specific things that could be funded that would give him the leg up that your daughter had in Minnesota?
Oh yeah, well, preschool availability of good preschools, and funding for those preschools. That was really, and they had a lot of good parenting classes too to help us get to where we needed to be with our kids' development. I mean, we really went from having no place to live to my wife is in a master's program right now, and our kids are really doing really well. Our son is probably going to be, you know, he's just not doing as well as my daughter was at his age. But right. being able to have one parent home and available to the to children is everything.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. I think I see all the panelists nodding their head in agreement.
And congratulations, and keep up doing the good work.
Let's go to another call. We have quite a few to get to, and Jane is on the phone with us as well from Albuquerque, also with a comment about childhood education. Jane?
Hi, thank you for having me. So I work in early intervention, and I've worked with children for about 5 years. I think New Mexico has a good start as far as things that they offer with the free services, and you mentioned getting kids qualified through environmental risk, not only the medical factors. And there is a growing program that's available to families on the reservation, as our previous caller mentioned, at something called Growing in Beauty. But I think legislatively, these things could be funded if there was simply a cap to salary to, you know, school superintendents get or political people get. If they would just take some of that money, cap their salary, and pour it back into getting really quality workers into those free preschools, putting it back into family supports for the schools, I think a salary cap could very easily fund these things. And I just wish people were a little less selfish up in Santa Fe.
Thanks, Jane. Well, you're listening to the KUNM Collins Show live from the University of New Mexico. There's 146,000 kids in this state living in poverty. About 30% of children here have trouble finding enough food to eat. We're talking about what this means for our state and what needs to be done to fix it. And as lawmakers meet for their session in Santa Fe, what worries you most about your kids and the opportunities they have here? Is it education, job opportunities, maybe abuse or physical safety is your biggest concern? And if that's the case, is a get tough on crime approach really the way to fix a problem? If you want to weigh in on the conversation, the number to call is 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866 locally in Albuquerque. Toll-free number is 877-899-5866. Send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org or tweet at KUNM News. You can use the hashtag HealthNM. We're going to take a short break and be right back.
If you're getting a new car this year, consider giving the old one to KUNM as a 50th anniversary gift. In addition to our sincere gratitude, you'll get a hefty tax deduction and a KUNM membership just in time for those 50th anniversary celebrations. Donated cars and trucks are a big reason we've been able to reach this milestone year, for real. So call today to see if your car or truck qualifies. 888-KUNM-CAR, that's 888-586-6227.
Intelligence Squared US, where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues. The next topic up for debate: raise the federal gas tax to fund infrastructure.
$1 trillion. That is the work that is needed on the interstate system alone.
Give us more money. More money, more money, more money. No talk about how to make it more efficient, how to make it more effective.
That's all coming up on Intelligence Squared US.
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico, a KUNM reporting project providing in-depth, investigative, and continuous coverage of public health and the impacts of poverty in our state. Well, we just heard from quite a few ideas in terms of some of the things that aren't on the legislature, aren't on the call, caps on salaries for superintendents. You know, there is a K-5 pilot project and some early childhood education issues that are being considered. Some callers weighing in with their opinions on how that could help. Veronica, you have quite a long list there of legislative issues that you think need attention. Why don't you tell us what some of the biggest ones are?
Sure. So we talked about family economic security and the high poverty rate. And Senator, there's Representative McCanley has House Bill 79, which would raise the working family's tax credit to 20% of the earned income tax credit, and it would be paid for by cutting capital gains tax deduction. Actually, that this will be heard today, and you know, families use those dollars for things that they don't usually have the money for, like paying for eyeglasses or buying tires. You know, those kinds of things make a big difference to a family. We also have a big problem in New Mexico of predatory lending. And the predatory lending can get so out of hand in terms of the family not being able to pay, refinancing, where they can pay over 300% interest. Representative Roy Balcavallero, House Joint Resolution 11, would cap predatory lending at 36%. Unfortunately, it was unanimously voted down in the House Business and Employee Committee on Tuesday, but that could have been a difference. It's unconscionable that we have this problem. Senator Scherer has Senate Bill 145 to reimpose a food tax. This we greatly oppose. It's a regressive tax. We completed a health impact assessment that looks that it would negatively impact the health of New Mexicans, particularly the poor. We have the third highest child hunger rate, so it doesn't make any sense at all to do something of this type.
Because families would have to pay more to feed their
exactly,
kids.
And disproportionate amount of, if the poorer you are, the higher percentage of your income you're paying in taxes with a sales tax. And food, the poor also, a larger part of their income is going to food. So it's a double whammy for them. Medicaid, Human Services Department requested $85 million. They need $185 million. And say they will make up $100 million in savings. We've got to fully fund Medicaid. And then lastly, I want to talk about the curfew. And on the surface, you know, enacting a curfew make
and
sense.
And this bill would let local governments enact their own curfew.
Yes,
regulations.
And what we feel about this is that we oppose it because it leads to the criminalization of kids. It gets them into the juvenile justice system where they become socialized to that. For not really committing a crime other than we making it a criminal act to be out after a certain time. We need a more proactive approach that has activities for youth so that they can engage in safer behaviors. But to criminalize it, we believe, will just create a bigger problem.
Gilbert, I bet you have some experience with that because you're working at the Health Leadership High School. I mean, in social work, do you see this kind of legislative approach often where what could be a normal activity by a kid and, you know, walking down the street at night can introduce them to, you know, the criminal justice system?
Actually, you know, many of our students work. They get out about 11, 1130 sometimes. They're working to actually contribute to their families, you know, well-being. If this were to pass again, let's be very clear. This targets adolescents. It's not like you have elementary age kids out beyond curfew. This is focused at adolescents, and it's, again, continuing that pipeline to prison. You cannot continue to just put them in a system that's going to increase factors for them to fail academically, get their juvenile record opened and started because of a curfew violation. Now, I agree there needs to be monitoring of things, but what are we providing for young people that's a healthy outlet for them to be out and about? But a lot of our young people are out. They do work, and they need the ability to, or they pick up their families, they drive, they have one car. If we set up a scenario that a curfew is across the board, what does that look like for enforcement? Do we even have the officers to be focusing on that, or are there other things that they could be spending their time on? It's, you know, we got to be cautious around laws that impact a certain target population. I do want to say it's going to impact primarily adolescents, adolescents coming from probably impoverished areas, or young people of color. I mean, that is the reality of it.
Why is that?
Because if you look at the areas of town that get most attention, I don't think it's I honestly do believe that there are higher presence of police in areas where there's higher crime, and that's going to be in areas of poverty. So who lives there? It's going to be youth who come from those backgrounds. They're not all up to bad. And if you look at a lot of our kids, I know because I work with them daily. They work. They come to school tired. We start at a later time, and I say, "What's going on?" I was at work till 11:30. What do? I wash dishes. I'm a cook. I got to get home and get back. If a young person is in, just stop for that, honestly, we have to be real. They're not always up to bat. So, yes, we have an issue. Does it require that much attention, legislative focus? I think there's other things that keep looking at for well-being of young people other than a curfew and something punitive.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to, I totally agree, and I think sometimes this goes back to why is New Mexico continually at the bottom of these child well-being indicators, and that I think that's barking up the wrong tree. I totally agree. And it goes back to what's not being provided In terms of attention to, and you know, my specialty is infants. Infants don't have a voice. Infants don't stay out after curfew. Infants don't get in trouble and expelled from school, so they don't have a voice, and they don't get a lot of attention. Yet, in the Child Protective Services, it's almost 40% are children birth to three that are taken into protective custody. It's also the highest age group where there are deaths, infant deaths from abuse and neglect. And we're sort of not talking about that. I think it makes people uncomfortable. I think, one, they're not knowledgeable. It makes them uncomfortable. But if we think about then adolescence, what hasn't been laid down early on in terms of relationship, support, knowledge about the importance of connection and attending to those emotional needs as well as physical needs?
We have a caller on the line from Taos. Shadden is with us. Hi, Shadden.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks.
I was involved in a program with foster children, and one of the primary reasons that children seem to be taken away from their family of origin has to do with alcohol and drugs. And I would like to hear what your thoughts are on that.
I think you're absolutely right. Good morning. That in the cases that I work with and consult on, and again, this is seven different judicial districts throughout New Mexico, that substance abuse is a very kind of unfortunately common denominator. We have young parents, we have older parents, we have parents that are abusing alcohol, heroin, opiates, and now meth. We have a so. When we look at what children need and what is impaired in terms of parenting and substance abuse, again, our systems are not coordinated. So we may have substance abuse and treatment facilities that are not acknowledging that there's also a parental role, or the parental support services are not including treatment and rehabilitation services. And how we assess the impact on the baby and what needs to happen in terms of reunification or a change of plan. All of these things take a skilled workforce to assess and make recommendations and inform our courts. And we don't have, there's huge waiting lists for inpatient treatment. There's a lot of barriers and deterrents for people getting treatment for substance abuse.
Would the Infant Behavioral Health Services bill that I know you're supporting, would that give any more resources to that issue?
It would give resources to parents in terms of having someone come to their home or having clinics that have, yes, absolutely is a short answer. And yes, it would provide services that would help parents acknowledge the impact of their behavior and their substance abuse and how we can coordinate services for those parents to get the treatment they need before, you know, in some ways sabotaging their success by putting them in situations of responsibility that they may not be ready for yet. They need other kinds of treatments, helping them look at their child's needs and make decisions for the best interests of their child.
Veronica, I know that jibes with what you have been researching with the Kids Count survey, but what are some of the possible solutions to this issue? I mean, I know that you write about a multi-generational approach to solving issues like substance abuse and, you know, early childhood issues.
Well, it was touched on earlier about better coordination at the state level between what used to be a very functional children's cabinet, where Human Services Department, Children, Youth, and Families, the Public Ed Department, Workforce Solutions, all of these departments working together to work holistically with families. We get more bang for the taxpayer buck if we do that. I always talk about short-term and long-term impacts to addressing poverty. The more short-term impacts are the things that I've talked about, such as the tax credits and minimum wage, raising the minimum wage, putting an end to predatory lending, that sort of thing. But long-term, the biggest return on investment, the highest leverage investment that we can make is to invest in early childhood education. And it sounds like a broken record, like, well, are there other things we could do? Certainly there are other things that we could do and other things that merit funding. But if we have limited resources, the best bang for the buck, the one that's going to make the biggest difference into ensuring that children do come to school ready to learn. Well, they're always learning, but ready to benefit from kindergarten, more likely to read by third grade, more likely to graduate from high school on time, is to invest in these early years from prenatal through pre-K is the best investment that we can make to cut the costs of remediation, incarceration. Home visitation for one family for a year, roughly $3,200 to $3,500 for one family. Huge difference. All the things that a parent can learn about interacting with that child. To incarcerate someone is $37,000 a year for years and years and years, and we're building more prisons. Does this really make sense? Is that what we want for New Mexico? I think that we want for a better quality of life for all of us. And if people got one message from me, we want to turn all of this around. It's not going to happen overnight, but let's put our resources behind the brain science, what we know can make the best and biggest difference for the quality of life and for the economy.
You know, I'll echo that. You know, just yesterday, I made a referral for a home visitation program for a first-time young family that we're working with. These programs are vital. I mean, the research is there nationwide. Home visitation programs have a huge impact on the betterment of families, children, and making sure that they're being tracked over the years. I think the cost and investment is absolutely worth it, looking at the prisons, the cost of that, and what we're doing reactionary. If we could invest as a state and say our community is worth more, our children are worth more, we're going to start to see the change. The problem is it's not going to be tomorrow. And so we have to be okay, because we're very accustomed to an immediate turnaround on things, that we have to invest to see the long-term gains. And I don't think that's been a priority of the state. And I know that's politics. However, we need to now stand up as a community and say enough is enough. We have to make this a priority. We have to start now. Recession or not, how the economy hit our state, we went back many, many years. And while we're still trying to recover, we have to do something now. And I know there's a lot of good people up in the legislature fighting for this, and hopefully we'll see a positive turnout for it.
We do have one more call with not much time to go, but I do think it's an important point. Andres from the Española area with a comment on energy money for funding these programs. Hi, Andres. Andres, are you with us? Looks like we lost Andres. Yeah, I lost Andres, but his comment had to do with our dependence on energy money and you know, the trouble that that causes in terms of funding our programs. But we have 3 weeks left in the legislative session and about a minute left for the show. So what are some of the things that you hope to see done if you know, you could just prioritize a couple of the bills that need to get through to one or two? Gilbert, what do you think?
I hope the curfew thing does not go further. I do want to see that. I think minimum wage is important for our families. We need to have families that can survive off a sustainable minimum wage. And I do hope early childhood education gets addressed and gets a positive vote at the end.
That music means we're out of time.
Oh, so I'm sorry.
I guess, no, that's okay. I misestimated the time, but I know there's a lot more. You can find out more online at KUNM.org. Thanks to our guest, Veronica Garcia of New Mexico Voices for Children, Gilbert Ramirez of Health Leadership High School, and mental health consultant Deborah Harris. Thanks also to special guest Anthony Mays of the New Mexico Attorney General's Office. If you missed part of this program or you want to hear it again, you can find it and past episodes on our website, KUNM.org. We're also podcasting the show on iTunes. Jefferson White was our engineer today. Kavi Movahead manages our phones, and Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and the Kanama Health Foundation. Find out more at publichealthnm.org. I'm Ed Williams. Thanks for listening.